Today's program has been brought to you by Clarkson Potter Publishers, the only dedicated lifestyle group within Random House. Potter invites readers to live well. We seek tastemakers, visionaries, and rising stars and partner with them to craft books and products that define their brand while engaging, entertaining, and instructing their audience. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to the show live every Monday at noon on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast at iTunes. On this week's show, I'm joined by set decorator and interior designer Lydia Marks. You've seen Lydia's work in films like The Devil Wears Prada, Sex and the City 1 and 2, Broken Flowers, and The Namesake. Today, we're talking about the life of a set decorator and hopefully learning a few tricks of the trade along the way. So thanks for joining us, Lydia.
Thank you for having me.
So the first thing I want to talk about is your background, because one thing I'm curious about is if, like me, you were always the weird girl who noticed the wallpaper in movies more than the actual movie itself. I think that's the first clue I had as a younger child that maybe something was different about me, that I didn't notice the stories and things.
I actually came to notice the wallpaper and people's surroundings more through photography than film.
Oh, okay.
I studied documentary photography I started in high school, and I continued on in college. I went to the museum school and Tufts University in Boston. And one of the things that I realized when I was studying documentary photography was that people would quickly judge a subject based on the subject's surroundings. Mm. And I found myself verbally trying to explain away certain, I don't know, things in the room or places that people found themselves and say to people, well, no, she just happened to be passing this street corner and I captured this sign behind her. But the way that people's surroundings feed into how you view them became kind of an obsession. Mm-hmm. And I started doing some documentary video because of that, in order to give people a voice and let them dictate a little bit more how you read into their surroundings, mm-hmm. I guess, and inform who they are. And then I quickly realized you could edit anything you wanted and change that as well. But that's kind of how I came to notice the surroundings people were in.
So how did you make that leap from the documentary world into set decorating? Or did interior design come first?
No, set decorating came first. When I graduated college, I worked at museums in photography departments. I worked at a museum in San Francisco called the Ansel Adams Center for Photography. And then when I moved back to New York, I worked at MoMA. I worked with a fabulous curator who is really a great proponent of the modernists that I loved, like Robert Frank and photographers like that, Lee Friedlander. So it was an amazing environment to get to see and meet some of these people and see their work and really learn their history. And I stayed there a few years and then sort of missed being more hands-on and creating mm-hmm. my own things. So at that point, I found an old friend who was an art director on music videos. And I said, get me on set. I want to see what people do in the art department. And I kind of went and just did anything I could to see how the different jobs broke down and where mm-hmm. I might fit in.
What music videos did you get to check out?
Well, that one was actually Beck, Devil's Haircut.
That's a good one.
It was a great one.
Get
it
your
was
feet
great.
In there on.
Yeah, it was great. And so I worked on that, and then I quickly found my place mm-hmm. there.
So how did you decide? Were you curious at all in staying in music videos, or did you know you wanted to move into films?
Well, there was a time in New York, I guess probably about 15 years ago, where there was a lot of money being spent on music videos, and there was a lot of access to them, whether you were in the film union or mm-hmm. not, because it was just a bit more open of a community then, and they were very creative. Then, you know, certain events happen where, you know, at first I worked in the non-union world and then mm-hmm. I became a union decorator. And that sort of, there was also a shift in the community at that point of how much work you could do based on whether jobs were union or not. And mm-hmm. I quickly was offered a few films that were smaller films and on location. So I would go away for 4 or 5 months at a time and work on films and, you know, try to figure out how to decorate someone's world in a place I had never been and had no sources. And this was also before everybody was on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't quite as easy to just overnight something that you found online when you needed it. You kind of had to meet people and find it locally and really get to know the area quickly. So that took me away from the videos and more into the film. Mm-hmm. And then I continued doing smaller films and then gradually getting bigger films at the same time as doing a lot of TV commercials.
So tell me a little bit about the process of decorating for a film. Where do you start? And do you have, what's like, do you have a team of people or is this sort of a one woman
job? Oh, yeah. There's a team and it's very collaborative, which I really, really love about film. And it starts with a production designer, and all designers work differently. Some designers will give you a color palette for the whole movie, and they'll say, okay, this character is going to be in blues and greens and have, you know, very hard lines, and this character, her furniture should be softer, and we're going to use a lot of patterns, and, you know, it's different people work differently. I like working that way because mm-hmm. it gives you a little bit of a structure or a guideline to start. Sometimes the beginning of a project can be very overwhelming because you're still learning what the director wants to see and how the director is hoping to express who these characters are visually. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have only, I don't know, 30 seconds of screen time to create a world that can be read easily by the audience so they can really see who this character is supposed to be, and you may never go back there again, mm-hmm. but it's got to inform quickly. And that goes from everything from their wallpaper to their collection that they may have had from when they were 5 years old and, you know, have kept, and why did they keep it and where is it placed in their house? And do you really as a viewer even notice it, or is it something that's subliminal and you sort of read it without even realizing, which is always a nice trick to be able to pull off too.
Exactly. I mean, when you can really nail that, I mean, I can think of a few films offhand. I mean, something, when you think about films like Wes Anderson films where mm-hmm. those details say, like one still shot of someone's room tells you so much about that character, all the way up to a movie that I loathe but loved the set of was One If by Land, I think is what it's called, with Matthew McConaughey mm-hmm. and Sarah Jessica Parker. And there was a bedroom that I believe was Zooey Deschanel's character, or no, not Kristen Ritter, Kristen Ritter's room. And I think I took so many like actual photographs of the television screen yeah. because I thought in that one room they kind of nailed who that character was, and you didn't need to see anything else to kind of understand mm-hmm. who she was. And when you can do that well, it's kind of amazing because mm-hmm. you don't have to sort of tell a whole backstory.
Right. So there's a lot of trying to figure out how to do that, but also there's a lot of different groups of people to please. And depending on if you're on a studio film or a smaller project, depends on how many groups you're pleasing mm-hmm. with something. But, you know, I mean, we've had weeks on certain films where the amount of discussion on what someone's sofa should look like would, you know, kind of surprise most people, I think. But, you know, there are these things that people can get stuck on and that they really feel are important. And you have to kind of go with it and give them the time and give them the options that you feel are going to satisfy what they're trying to get. And then some actors have very strong opinions on what they want on their
sets. Really?
Some have the right, you know, through their contract to actually comment on their sets and see them beforehand and approve them.
Wow, I had no idea.
And, you know, in general, my goal is always to make an actor feel mm-hmm. like this is their place, whether yes. it's their office or their home. So I don't mind that at all because that's what we're there for, you mm-hmm. know? But, depending on, I guess, who's sort of driving the project. And it's always different. Television's very different than films because you're really working more with writers. Mm-hmm. In film, you don't usually see the writer all that often unless it's a writer-director, in which case, you know, that's narrowing down a little bit of the control. The production designer obviously has a big picture in mind mm-hmm. when they start the project, and how we communicate that is always different. Sometimes it's through research that they've been doing for months ahead of me coming on, and it used to be done at the New York Picture Library, which was a great resource, and I don't know how many people even go there anymore because everything is available online, all these images. But, you know, finding pictures of real people in real environments and lots of things, I mean, different materials that you can find and just use that to inform a direction. And, you know, there's a lot of, we build a lot of exteriors and do a lot of natural like in Sex and the City 2, we built the whole exterior of an inn that was supposed to be like a New England inn, and we did all live grass and trees, and so you're working with a lot of landscaping at that point. So the research can come from anywhere, depending on the subject.
Mm-hmm. So what's the average day-to-day life of a set decorator like? Are you working on multiple films at once, or do you typically, are you on one project at a time?
One project at a time, and they're actually really, usually very intense days, because films are made in a, you know, a condensed period of time, and you generally don't have enough time ever in the day to get everything done, like most things, I'm sure. People in film tend to start work very early in the morning, so usually by 7 a.m., someone's calling and saying, where's the blank? We can't find it. Or, you know, we're trying to dress this set and we don't have any doorknobs. And, you know, and then the
tracking. And you're responsible for all of that.
All of that. Ooh. Yeah, all of that. So, you know, it starts really early in the morning, and then kind of meet. I usually have several assistants who will be out shopping for me. The bigger the project, the less I get to be on the ground and finding new things, which is, you know, a blessing and a curse, I suppose, right? It's nice to be on the big projects, but I do love being out there on the street and finding the new design. And sometimes it's just inspiring to just, you know, be the person out there, and it feeds your ideas. But generally, I spend a few hours looking with the assistants at what they've shot, kind of narrow it down, create a look from what I've been brought, and then start having some meetings and meet with a production designer, meet with directors, depending on what stage.
Are you constantly in mood board mode?
Yeah, my whole office becomes a mood board. And the bigger the office, the better, because we can fill those walls so fast with, you know, wallpaper, samples, and fabrics, and photos, and, you know, and then when you're working with a great costume designer, you get pictures of the actors in the costume, so you know what colors they're working with, and you can start to incorporate that into your work. And then the locations obviously play a big part of what we're doing. So as they start to shoot later in the job, they'll start to actually present us with places we might be able to go and dress a real location. And that just adds a whole other element in, because then suddenly you're dealing with, let's say, a wall of windows that you never anticipated having in a room that you were designing. So what kind of window treatments do they get? So each phase of the process brings along new things to react to and to find ways to handle and decorate and solve. And then I go to sets and I start dressing with the set dressing team that I have. There's a lead man who is in charge of all the set dressers, and he sort of will, he or she will divide up the labor. So there's people everywhere where we're either prepping or shooting or wrapping. And on a bigger movie, you're doing all of the above in multiple places. So there's days where we could have 10 locations being dressed. Some of them, you know, a restaurant that's going to shoot the next day, and all it needs is some cleared artwork so we don't get sued for using someone else's artwork that we're not supposed to. And then, you know, sometimes it's a full dress or a build on a soundstage. So we have people all over, and I go from place to place and see what they're doing and try to, you know, make things fit and look great and look like we expect them to look. So nobody's surprised when they come in at 5 a.m. to shoot it.
Well, speaking of big films, I want to talk about some of your more memorable rooms you created for sort of iconic films. I love what you did for Devil Wears Prada, but I want to talk about Sex and the City first, namely because I think everyone my age was kind of obsessed with Sex and the City, the television show, and I wanted to be Carrie Bradshaw. I wanted to have that room. So when you got the opportunity to sort of reimagine her apartment, which was made over in the first film?
In the first film.
How do you tackle something like that where the interior is already kind of so iconic and people remember all the details? What was the process of reimagining her home like?
Well, we sort of thought that Carrie had reached a point where she had made some decisions about how she wanted to experience, you know, this phase of her life and how it was going to be different for her. And we started with, you know, some color to try to change the world that way, because the architecture obviously was basically staying the same. We thought she would probably be in a position at that point where she might redo her kitchen because it was time, maybe create a place to eat, because she's kind of always eating on her little coffee table in her living room, which, you know, was sort of, I think, part of like the the way everybody kind of knew her apartment mm-hmm. and how she lived in it was, you know, this sort of two-room living. And then, you know, Carrie's famous for keeping her shoes and sweaters in her oven because she never cooked. And so the grown-up Carrie maybe was going to, you know, use her kitchen a little more, or at least, you know, design her world so it fit her lifestyle. So we started with some really intense colors. We used this great electric blue color mm-hmm. on her walls. And then, you know, going through, like, what does she need? She needs a place to sofas, little sofas mm-hmm. that fit.
Those sofas were so cute.
Yeah, we made those. There's no furniture that's really built. I don't think that's really small enough to do what we needed. So we sort of found shapes and stuff we liked and then designed them and had them built for us. And, you know, we wanted her to be able to have a cocktail party and have places for people to sit that wasn't on the floor around this coffee mm-hmm. table. We wanted her to have a glamorous place to use as her vanity. And we found this beautiful mirrored Art Deco piece that we brought in. And, you know, she had maybe a little bit more disposable income that she could spend mm-hmm. on accessories and artwork over her bed. We did like a gallery style hanging of things that she had collected over the years, was our theory on it. She had found, you know, ticket stubs and invitations and small pieces that friends had made and framed everything and then did a big gallery hang, which I think the onset dresser wanted to kill me for because every time something moved, they had to straighten 10,000 pictures. But
it was worth it. The result was fantastic. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about more film sets and your interior design work as well.
Great.
Today's featured book is The Butler's Guide to Running the Home and Other Graces by Stanley Ager and Fiona St. Aubin. Perched on an island off the shores of Cornwall, England, the soaring castles of St. Michael's Mount have been home to the St. Aubin family since 1647. For nearly 30 years, Stanley Ager, one of the most esteemed butlers of the 20th century, ensured that St. Michael's Mount was an impeccable place to live and a gracious and welcoming one for guests to visit. Revered by everyone from royalty to the estate staff, Stanley Ager considered it his calling to run a home gracefully and efficiently. Several of the men who he had trained at St. Michael's Mount went on to serve in the royal household at Buckingham Palace and at British embassies throughout the world. But you don't need a manor to benefit from Ager's wisdom on homekeeping. This carefully detailed, charmingly illustrated, eminently useful volume offers important insights and techniques, including how to wipe a glass or a chandelier until it sparkles, fold napkins precisely in 6 different ways, polish furniture or silver to a mirror finish, lay a beautiful table and serve a meal impeccably, and much, much more. The Butler's Guide to Running the Home and Other Graces by Stanley Ager and Fiona St. Aubin is $21.99 and available wherever books are sold.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with set decorator and interior designer Lydia Marks. Before the break, we were talking about Lydia's work with Sex and the City, and before we move on from that, I want to know what happens to the things that you decorate with that we were talking about. You obviously have to save some of them to use in sequels and things like that, but who gets to keep that stuff? Please tell me you kept the sofa.
I don't have any sofas, no. I have a really great mirror that was over Meryl Streep's desk in Devil Wears Prada. That I really came to love because it had a little bit of a great backstory. But in general, what happens to the stuff depends on the project. But mm-hmm. a show like Sex and the City, where they were making sequels, we stored everything in storage that was ours. We rent a lot of things, so especially in a movie like that, where the items that you want to use can be more expensive than you can afford to buy. Mm-hmm. We rent them and give them back, sadly, when we're done. But sometimes we store things and then we send it to the studio and they just keep it until they either decide that they're not going to do any sequel or there's no pickups that they have to do after, you know, you never know if there's going to be a reshoot of something. So they hold on to it usually till the movie opens and then have a sale somewhere. And
I would like to be at that sale.
Yeah, get on the list.
I would have been at the sale for Carrie's old apartment. I think I would have been at that one, too. Yeah. I had an epic quest to track down the pink curtains she used to have in the television version, which were, I think, Marimekko curtains.
Uh-huh.
And I finally tracked down that pattern.
Did you get
years
it?
Ago. I did. They were a little bit of a statement, though. They're bright pink mm-hmm. curtains, which on the set seem to look a little bit more subdued than they do in real life.
Yeah,
they're
color
like
definitely.
Quite pink. But I want to ask one more question about the sets. First thing, I want to know if there are any current or past movies that sort of have always stuck in your mind that you particularly love the sets of. They don't have to be your work, but what are some of your favorite movie sets?
Well, I tend to, going back to my documentary, you know, past, I tend to like movies with very natural sets, mm-hmm. and I tend to like a lot of New York-based films. So I'm a huge Scorsese fan. I'm a huge Woody Allen fan, and I think, you know, kind of growing up with those movies of, you know, especially like New York in the 70s, and I think that it's really interesting how these things influence how people perceive mm-hmm. the real place. And you know, I think like especially with something like Woody Allen, where you may not really notice the set decoration, I think that his films really created what people perceive Upper West Siders to live like, even now, or professors on the Upper West Side. You know, it's very specific, and these big libraries and eclectic furnishings, mm-hmm. antiques mixed with, you know, more common everyday items. And I tend to really like things like that.
Woody Allen films, I feel like, feel more to me like real New York than real New York feels to me. I've had moments in Upper West Side apartments where I feel like I'm in a Woody Allen film, mm-hmm. and I have to remind myself these are decorated to look like real New York.
Yeah, and it kind of, one bleeds into the other so much that you almost can't separate where one stops and the other one starts at this point. And I sort of love that because it just becomes real, you know?
So what do you think is the biggest difference between set decorating for a film or for commercial and residential decorating? Because you do both.
Well, the longevity of residential is really nice because it's always sad for me when we spend a lot of time creating a world and then you shoot it and then it's exciting. And then the next day you walk in and it's a pile of lumber on a stage and it's, you know, the furniture is being wrapped up in bubble wrap and shipped away. And it's just so much work for something. I mean, I know it's on film, but the physicalness of it mm-hmm. is very temporary. So in residential, it's nice to know that people are going to live with this. It also affects, obviously, the kinds of choices you make because what, you know, I'll upholster a fabric sofa in a silk, let's say, for a movie mm-hmm. that wouldn't last a week, you know, in someone's real life. And you can't really do that. You know, people are spending money and they need to mm-hmm. be able to live with their things. I mean, certain people are always open to the idea of maybe a room that's kind of off limits to the kids. But, you know, that's not a lot of the spaces we work on. A lot of our clients have children, which is great. Mm-hmm. So it's created a situation for me where I've had to learn how to find things that I think are beautiful but durable. And mm-hmm. what kind of durable, you know, is it that it's cleanable or it's just not going to wear out because you use it every day? And so there's that. And then there's the, you know, in a film, you're really struggling to create character.
Yes.
And that's really one of the priorities, big priority. In a home, you don't need to do that as much. But when you can sort of get to who your clients are and start to maybe help them find things to collect that express that. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's where I think some of my prior work really informs my current interior design work is that I like to really not have projects look like they were done by Marx in France.
Yes.
But that the client maybe has collected these items over the years and will continue to do that even if I really found all those pieces for them. And, you know, I like the idea of making my clients into characters mm-hmm. and then expressing who they are in their home and really having it feel like them as opposed to feel like something done by my firm.
Exactly. Well, I think, how do you sort of balance that difference? I love that you sort of mentioned the idea of collections that look like the owner has them, but you actually bought them all mm-hmm. for them. What percentage of your actual residential work does that happen? I'm always curious when I walk into a house that's been designed by a designer, like if those pieces are really theirs, or do you feel like you mostly end up buying those collections?
Well, some of it depends on how long you get to work on the project for, because interior design is a much slower process than film. So I can decorate many, many, many homes in a film in let's say 9 months, and I've had clients where I'm still waiting to receive furniture. Now, 2.5 years later, you know, we are custom making everything because we can. So the scale of it fits, the materials work, and we have that time, which is such a luxury compared to film. I mean, that's the hardest part of film is finding the pieces that you can get your hands on immediately. Mm-hmm. The custom work happens on film too, but you have to really know you want to do it early on in the game because it's hard at the last minute. So it depends with clients how long you're working with them, mm-hmm. because the big pieces come first and you get to the accessories later. So if you're still working on a project and you can keep bringing things in and sort of see like people are really responding to a certain, you know, thing that you've proposed, then you can kind of keep going with it.
Yeah. That's great. Well, what is, I'm dying to know sort of what one of your biggest pie in the sky type projects is. Like, what would you love to just have someone like hand in your lap and say, decorate this project?
Probably a hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did one hotel roof bar, which was a great project. And it's at the Strand. It's called Top of the Strand in the city. And it was a great project because it was a roof that overlooked the Empire State Building, great skyline, and completely open. You know, they just wanted to see what my ideas were. So we had a good time with that. And then because the conditions actually on the rooftop bar in Manhattan are a little tough between, mm-hmm. this has a retractable roof. So there's a lot of different weather patterns, mm-hmm. throughout the day. Like it gets very hot when you close it at night. Obviously very sunny during the day, cold in the winter, although it's heated. We had to really, you know, change it every 6 months. So we did a seasonal redesign because fabrics, oh, wow. would fade and plants, mm-hmm. would die and things like that. So we started doing a summer redesign and then a winter redesign. And we got to have some fun with the fabrics there. And so I can only imagine if you get to do an entire hotel, you know, what you could do. So
I can only imagine how exhausting that would be. Whenever I see a hotel that like a designer's done from top to bottom, I just kind of shudder at how much work. It sounds amazing to me, but also terrifying, yeah. to think you have to think about everything from the sheets to the pens on, yeah. the bedside table.
Well, at the Strand, the last redesign we did was a Trina Turk inspired design. Oh, so we got to work with her with her new collection of outdoor fabrics, which were fantastic. And that inspired us to also dress the bar staff in Trina Turk dresses, mm-hmm. and so we really got to do the whole thing top to bottom, like you're saying,
yeah.
and that gave me a taste of what a great hotel project could be.
That sounds like fun. Well, yeah. it's interesting because so your professional life, you always have sort of someone who's handing you a color palette, a theme, a story that you need to tell. When it comes to your personal life, how does your style differ from the work that sort of has your name on it out in your professional life? What's your personal style like?
I would say my personal style is eclectic, and I like to mix old and new. It changes, though. I used to be really, really into mid-century furniture, you know, like everybody, I think. But I still love it, but definitely more in limited pieces than I used, mm-hmm. to. I really, you know, I like the idea of transforming things from one thing to another. Maybe it's, you know, a lacquer paint over a French antique, and you know, kind of mixing that in now to the world of you know, what I have at home. And I love color. So, mm-hmm. you know, I tend to probably use like brighter patterns and colors in my own world where I can, because nobody's afraid of it. And, you know, it's my house. I can do it. And I feel like, you know, often clients are like, oh, what if I get tired of it? And I always say, well, you can change it. It's just a curtain. It's easier for me to change it maybe because I have the resources. So, mm-hmm. I'll use materials like that other people might shy away from.
Do you feel like you are energized to decorate your own home when you get home, or are you kind of exhausted and don't want to do it?
It depends on the time. Normally, I don't spend a lot of time decorating my home, but I've been collecting things that I love for a long time. So, you know, I'll spend some time moving things around and kind of changing the way the space feels. And then, you know, out at a flea market, you find some beautiful ceramic piece and suddenly you have a new mantle and, you know, you work with that. And so, and of course, when I'm out shopping all the time, I'm finding things that I love too and then need to bring them home.
That's got to be hard. Have you ever found a piece that you ended up having to use for a set that you really wish you could have kept for yourself?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. What's the best way to make a set is to really love your furnishings.
Do you get to take, what if you fell in love with something that you ended up using on a movie? Could you buy it back from the movie at
sometimes,
the end?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes when they have the sale, I buy it back. And that's actually the case with the mirror I was talking about, yeah. earlier on Prada was, There, it was a very important piece of set dressing because it was right over her desk. And so we spent a lot of time looking for the perfect thing, and I found a whole range of things that were very expensive, and I would bring them in for a day, hang them, see who liked them, and if we liked them, and if they worked, and then take them back out and try another three or four mirrors. And I was at a really a junk store, I would say, in upstate New York, and found this old mirror and thought it just had a great shape. And then I had our scenic department paint it, and I didn't like the way that looked, and we painted it again and again and again, and ended up finally with this layered paint that was sort of peeling off and silver leafed with paint showing through, and that was the winner. And it was truly a $40 item.
That's amazing.
That won, and I ended up being able to buy that about a year later. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, so what do you have coming up that people can sort of look for? Are you working on any films now? Or
Not working on any films right now, but we have a project that's going to be featured in Lux Magazine October 16th. One of our favorite projects we've done is a home in Greenwich, Connecticut.
That's great.
That we designed, and we're really excited to see the magazine come out.
That's great. Well, anybody listening is interested in checking out Lydia's work, you can visit her at lydiamarks.com, and you can also check out your work with Marks and Franks. And I think that's, those are all your websites, right? Is there anywhere else people can check out your work?
No, I think that would cover it. You'd find us, all the links are on those pages.
Well, definitely check out the movie section. There are a ton of films you've done that I think people would be surprised and recognize, and they can get familiar with your work. So thanks for talking with us today, Lydia.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.